this conversation was officially devolved into, hey, do you know anybody over 35 from Atlanta? They're loving this.
Welcome to Radio Labyrinth Presents. I'm your host, Steph Swain, and today my guest is the entire definition of a Renaissance man. He's an actor, he's a writer, he's a producer, he's a director, he's a DJ, he's a mentor. And just to round it out and make him sound like a human being, he's also a husband and a father. So welcome, Diallo Riddle.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Congratulations to you and your creative partner, Bashir Salahuddin, on your multi-year deal that you guys made with Warner Brothers. That is like crazy.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, if we can talk Hollywood shop, it feels like a great place to be in the sense that there's always been ideas that we, you know, there are some ideas that we want to write, but then there are also ideas that we hear from our fellow writers where we're like, oh, that'd be a great show. So what an overall deal will allow you to do, it gives you a little bit of money so that you don't have to like worry about how to feed your family for a little bit. And then you have the time and the wherewithal to develop other shows with other people that you've either grown up loving, people, you know, your colleagues you respect, or up and coming writers who you've worked with. You're like, oh, that person, their idea for a show is a really special one. So why don't we try and make that happen?
I read, and I'm total superhero nerds on the show. One of the things that really intrigued me is that you guys were like, now you're going to have access to DC characters.
You got access to the DC universe at a time when I think DC is doing so many exciting things. I mean, like, you know, they're letting Ta-Nehisi Coates write Superman. And I mean, I feel like every day I read something out of the DCEU that I'm like, oh, this is exciting. Like, this is like, you know, it feels like we're in the Wild West, and that's a place where I think we feel very comfortable, because I think any property that we pursue, we're absolutely going to go out of our way to make sure that it's special and exciting, and that it appeals to people who don't read the comics, but to the people who do, like, they'll be like, oh, these are our fellow folks, you know, like they're not doing the things that when I was growing up, it seemed like every time Hollywood touched a comic book property, they would fundamentally change it. And it would always be like, I always imagine like some cigar chomping studio exec saying, okay, we're going to do the Flash, but maybe he doesn't run fast. Maybe he just talks fast. Like, there was always like that guy who always like kind of ruined it. And, you know, so when I was coming up, I remember like, you know, they tried to do the Punisher and it was terrible. There were so many comic books that were kind of ruined either in the development phase or by the time they came out, like nobody wanted to see them, and they were just bad. So I think nowadays the industry has a lot more respect for comic book creators than it did in the past. And the people who are writing the material are also more likely to be actual readers of the comics. So I think the industry has gotten better in that sense.
So did you see James Gunn's Suicide Squad? Have you seen that yet?
You know, I'm watching it this weekend. We've been so busy editing season two of Southside that I have not had the chance to watch it this week, but I'm definitely watching it probably Saturday night. You know, HBO Max is kind of home for us because it's the home of our show, Southside. But so we know the people who greenlit it. I'm just excited to see it. I think James brings a levity and a sense of fun to material that I just can't wait to see.
Yeah, I think it's total Guardians of the Galaxy meets Deadpool. 100%. It's so much fun. And
yeah,
Idris Elba as Bloodsport, I just read that he was talking about pitching a prequel where he fights Superman. And I was thinking, man, this is like right on the cusp of you guys rolling in here.
I mean, for real. And yeah, I also saw where James Gunn, his original idea was that the Suicide Squad was going to go after, they were going to go after Superman. I think this is a very exciting time to be at DC. I think this is when people are, like I said, I can't get too into specifics about what we're developing, but we're developing some characters that, I mean, I think that when the comic book community hears that we're developing them, they're not like, you know, Batman, the Penguin. It's not anything, but it's all those wonderful characters that if you actually read the comics, it's the characters that we talk about, you know.
Right.
a good example of a character that we're not currently developing with, and I wanted to, but somebody beat me to it, and I won't out him, but a pretty well-known actor slash producer beat us to Animal Man. Now, Animal Man is not a character that your aunts and uncles may know about, but like, if you read the comics, like, you know Animal Man, especially the version that came out in the 90s when I was reading. So I think that it's really about finding those characters out there that nobody's even thinking about and making something out of them.
Yeah, I totally, yeah, it's, people have seen Batman. We've seen all these ones a million times.
Iterations. Yeah. Can't agree more. I mean, like, we're literally, and there's so many that haven't, I was shocked when I saw the list of DC characters that have never been shown in any TV show or any film. A couple of them have made the animated series, but most of them, I mean, like, just kind of, I'm like, why has nobody ever done anybody with, you know, anything with that? And so, you know, you sit down with the DC people and you run through a list of your, like, you know, dream list. And in running through with them our dream list, we came up with the concept for a show that I'm very excited about. I hate to be a tease, not in a position to really talk about it yet, but I think if that one goes forward, people are going to love it because I think it's going to be funny. But the stakes are real. And yeah.
Are we talking like this is something that would be on, it could be on Cartoon Network, or is this like Invincible where it would be, it would have to be like,
you know, it would be live action, and it would be, I think, tonally very similar to Doom Patrol, which is another show that I really like. You know, I think we're talking to Greg Berlanti's company about perhaps co-producing it because, you know, they've been successful in getting a lot of DC properties out there. I think it would have the, it would have the humor and the comedy that Bashir and I bring to a show like Southside. And a little bit of Sherman Showcase too, because the thing about Sherman Showcase is that over there, we're inventing sort of, when we pitched it, we called it, we said what 30 Rock was to SNL, Sherman Showcase will be to Soul Train. And that's what got that idea sold. But in truth, what we really wanted to create was at the time we were saying it was like the Marvel Cinematic Universe of Black music. So if you think of Prince as being a superhero, we'll have our version of Prince. If you think of James Brown as a superhero, we'll have our version of James Brown. And that's how we wrote Sherman Showcase. We were always introducing these larger than life figures, almost like comic book characters, but in the world of music.
You know, before we go further into it, I have some questions, like things that I just wanted to know about you, because I'm such a fan and everything. I've lived in the Metro Atlanta area for like 22 years, and I know you grew up in Southwest Atlanta. What was it like up in Southwest?
Fantastic. You know, so much of my, by the way, just to keep it in sort of like the comic books land, so much of my Atlanta experience in childhood was kind of shaped by where I was buying comics at that time. So the very first comic book store I ever sort of remember buying, the first time I walked into a store and bought comic books, it was at the Food Giant on, I think it was on Adams, deep in the heart of like Adamsville, when you're sort of out there near Charlie Brown Airport. That was sort of the first, I bought some Archie comics at the grocery store. But the first time I expressly went to a place to buy comics, it was some G.I. Joe comics, was at West End Books, right by the Mall West End. And, you know, West End Books, it was just a newsstand, but I still remember the smell of all that newsprint when you'd walk in. And I sort of missed that. When I got a little more sophisticated, I was all about Oxford Books and Comics. So I would go down Peachtree to Oxford Books and Comics. I remember when they opened Oxford 2, which was just comic books. I don't even know if Oxford Books and Comics is still there. I know that, I feel like Oxford Comics, if the pandemic hasn't killed it, is still right there along Piedmont. Right before it gets to Peachtree. But, you know, those were my comic book stores, and I would always go in there. And, you know, for a while I was a sucker for a gatefold, you know, comic, thinking that it was going to go up in value, but, you know, in the McFarlane years. But I truly do cherish those memories because, you know, that comic book collection, my first comic book collection, which I amassed from like the age of 10 to the time I went off to college, is the comic book collection that I sadly had to part with and sell to get my first ticket out to Los Angeles. But, you know, those comic books, they got me out here, and they bought me my plane ticket because my parents didn't have it at the time. And, you know, so comic books have been there from the beginning. But yeah, I love Atlanta. I don't get back nearly enough after the passing of my mother. My father passed a little bit before her. So when you lose both parents, you get to the town a lot less frequently because you don't have that, you know, desire to, it's not a desire to get there, but you know, you just don't get back for every Christmas and every Thanksgiving like you did. That said, I still have two sisters who live in Atlanta, in the Atlanta metro area. So I think we're going to try and come home for the first, if the Delta variant doesn't kill us, then Delta Airlines will carry us there and we'll come and visit this Christmas. So that's the big Atlanta plan right now. I love Atlanta. I miss it. Like I said, don't get back there nearly enough. Every time I go there, I see, I'm like, look, kids, there are going to be some trees over and it's a store. Well, they're definitely going to be some trees over and it's a parking lot. Like the trees are disappearing at an alarming rate. They're just building up everything. Houses that I used to love have been knocked down and condominiums put up, but you know, it's still Atlanta. And I still have family, lots of family and friends there.
Well, you know, when I wanted to ask you, because it's not exactly the neighborhood that you grew up in, it's right down the road, but you were mm-hmm. probably a teenager when Outkast and Goody Mob yeah, came man. Out. And that 100. Was like, that was a big deal to me. I'm from Downriver, Detroit. So it was a big deal to us, but I know like that being right in that area, the first like real hip hop group from the South that were huge.
We had some, but they were the first to sort of break big. I mean, like I remember Y'all So Stupid around like, Y'all So Stupid came out in like 91, somewhere in there. And we definitely had like Atlanta was weird in that at a time when hip hop was so divided between, you know, New York hip hop and West Coast / Houston hip hop. I feel like my childhood was all Miami based music. Like it was all what we call booty shake. So it was like, if you go to an actual party in Atlanta in the early 90s, it was all like, and you know, we were in middle school and high school, but like when you go to a party, like it was all like Uncle Luke and Two Live Crew and Splat Pack and Gucci Crew. Like they didn't even play, even when I would go back in 94 and 95, because I'd gone away to college that year, you know, it was still rare to hear Outkast in an Atlanta party. Like Outkast and Goody Mob and the whole Dungeon Family crew, they were such outliers for what we considered party music. I remember when I first went away to college, the idea that you would dance to Tupac and Biggie songs just seemed weird to me, because in Atlanta, we danced to 135 BPM Miami bass, Kilo Ali and the So-So Def All-Stars. Like that was what we danced to. All the Whoop There It Is tracks, that was the sound. But the cool thing about Outkast was that after a couple of Atlanta artists tried to break big and weren't able to make it, I remember Y'all So Stupid's album was called A Van Full of Pakistans, which was basically saying, I've got a lot of troubles. You know, the thing about Outkast is that they came out and everybody was sort of like, well, is this West Coast? Because they sound kind of like Souls of Mischief. But, you know, like, I feel like their lyrics are definitely firmly sort of more in an East Coast vein. And that was because nobody had really defined what Southern hip hop was going to sound like, you know? So they tried to figure out like, well, who did they copy? But truth be told, them two dudes like really set it off in a major way. And I'm pretty proud of the fact, this is in a time we had to go to a record store to buy CDs. I went to the record store, actually, I'll never forget this day. I'm pretty sure I went to Tower Records that day to buy Wu-Tang's Enter the 36 Chambers. Oh, but when I was going through the CD box, I saw this group named Outkast that I had never heard of on LaFace Records. I sort of knew a little bit about LaFace because if you're from Atlanta at that time, you knew Babyface had a label in town. I picked up the CD and the fourth track, I want to say it was the fourth track on it, it said, Welcome to Atlanta. And I was like, these dudes are from Atlanta? Like, and I turned it back over and I was like, Southern Playlist of Cadillac Music, huh? And I turned it back around and I saw they had a track called Welcome to Atlanta. That was it. That was all I knew about this group. I bought it, the CD, because I was like, these dudes are from Atlanta. And after I, you know, listened to 36 Chambers a bunch of times, I started listening to this Outkast CD. And I called up my friend and I was like, dude, there's a group from Atlanta that's talking about the 166. Now, if you're from Atlanta, the 166 is I think nowadays it's called Langford Parkway or something that. But like back then, like the idea that Atlanta, that a rap group with these kind of lyrics was calling out like, you know, stuff that was just Greenbrier, Headland and DeLow. They didn't come out with Elevators until later, but like you could tell immediately that they were from our neighborhood, and that was so cool to me. because we didn't have YouTube back in those days. You know what I'm saying? Like, they were from our neighborhood. It was crazy. Like, Greenbrier Mall, that whole area down off of Childress and Lyndhurst, like, the idea that we had a rap group was insane to us. So that's when we all started claiming the SWATs. And, you know, like, I feel like that was really the birth of something special in our town. And to this day, you know, we're thankful to them. I'll never forget the first time I saw them perform. It was at a place called My Brother's Keeper, which was like an, I feel like it was a 15 and over club, which meant everybody in there was 14. And we went to go see Outkast play there. And I'll never forget, they edited themselves. They were rapping for us and they did the whole first album damn near, but they sort of like self-muted. They had sort of like, they cleaned up the language in the songs. You know what I'm saying? Like, and that, you know, it was just great. I'll never forget that time. My Brother's Keeper was in that weird shopping mall that I think is still across the freeway from Greenbrier. Used to be called Westgate, I want to say, something like that. But anyway, this conversation has officially devolved into, hey, do you know anybody over 35 from Atlanta? They're loving this. I'm calling out all the old neighborhood spots. There was a Dairy Queen over there. It was like the only Dairy Queen in existence as far as I knew. And that Dairy Queen was right off of Campbellton Road. That Dairy Queen was there forever. I'm sure it's not there anymore.
Just in the time that I've lived here, I've seen things come and go. So yeah. I can only imagine. Well, you know, when you were a kid, what were like some of your favorite shows when you were a kid?
Oh,
that kind of influenced you, your writing style and whatnot.
Yeah, you know, love the Muppet Show. You know, when you're a kid, you back in those days, again, pre-YouTube, you just turned on the TV and you just wanted something, you know, to entertain you. And around like 4 or 5 o'clock, all the shows on Channel 46 and I think that's pretty much the only channel I watched was Channel 46. It would go from being cartoons to like shows from the 70s and early 80s that had gone into syndication. So I watched a lot of The Incredible Hulk and Wonder Woman. And I guess, you know, I guess that was the earliest exposure I had to superheroes. But I remember The Muppet Show being a little different and transformative because The Muppet Show was just funny on a different level to me. You know, like I really sort of connected with Kermit. He seemed like a sensible guy surrounded by lunatics, which is sort of like me and my friends. Like I always surrounded myself with some of the most colorful people that I could. But I was always a little bit like the Kermit. I was always the presentable one who was like, okay, now give it up for Fozzie or give it up for Gonzo. So that was really, and obviously we watched a ton of movies. I'll never forget the day that my parents actually bought cable. It was such a special day. I think I watched The Muppets Take Manhattan a million times. I watched Pee-wee's Big Adventure a million times. For whatever reason, I watched Rocky III a million times, though I don't think I've seen it since I was a child. You know, I think something about James Brown's Living in America. I was like, why are all these people making big noise about James Brown? He's got one song and it's Living in America. I didn't know a lot, but guys, my father wasn't really into like funk. My father, because there was a big age gap in my family, my father was really into jazz. Like he was more of a John Coltrane, Miles Davis, you know, type guy. And so, you know, I grew up listening to whatever was popular. The Beatles, for whatever reason, the Beatles got on my radar very early. I think because I heard that one of their members had been shot and killed. And that always made me have like a certain amount of empathy. So I was just like, oh, let me listen to their music. So the Beatles was on my radar and jazz music. So those were sort of like the three things that I was exposed to. Soul and funk came later, like when I sort of noticed that hip hop was from the West Coast was sounding like they were, you know, I was like, oh, that's that cool music. And then people say, oh, well, they sampled Parliament. They sampled this. And then I got really deep into that during my college years. And then lo and behold, I came out of college as a DJ because I didn't want to take a term time job. Well, actually, I got fired from my term time job at the Harvard Law Library because I fell asleep on the job a few too many times. So they fired me. So being a working class kid at Harvard, I needed some other way to like come up with some cash. I had a scholarship, but I needed just cash to spend. So I'll save you the long version of this story, but I became a DJ because there was only one DJ in the Harvard area. And he was a great DJ, a guy named by the name of Shock T. He was a great DJ. He did all the black parties, but there was only one of them and he charged a lot of money. So I was like, I see a niche here. I'm gonna buy some records down in Roxbury and I'm gonna become a DJ. And I think I went down there, I bought Mobb Deep's Survival of the Fittest, 12-inch. I bought Common Sense back when he was Common Sense, Common, but about Common Sense's Resurrection 12-inch and a few other 12-inches. So I would do those first parties with like 12 records. After about an hour, I was back to spinning the same record. Like, you know, I really had to know my audience well. I lowballed the other DJ. I charged a third of what he charged. So, you know, everybody who didn't have a lot of money could hire me. And I got better at it. I got my 10,000 hours in. So by the time I left Harvard, I was actually a really good DJ. You know, I did a lot of parties while I was there learning. When I came out to LA, once again, I had a lowly assistant position at Paramount, but I knew that I could make money DJing. So I started DJing at The Room, which is still there, The Room on Cahuenga Boulevard. That was like 1999. So yeah, that was the beginning of my professional DJ career.
But you met Bashir at Harvard, right?
I did. We were in an a cappella group we were in a choir group, Kaumba Singers. And it's funny because he was raised Muslim and I was basically raised Episcopalian / agnostic. So we were singing all these gospel songs, but like we were like two of the people who were kind of there for the aesthetic of the singing group, not, you know, we weren't hot. We weren't like, you know, virulent atheists, but we just, you know, we liked singing. so we formed a side group called Brothers, and we were going to sing all the popular Jodeci, Silk, Shy, Boyz II Men songs of the era with our friend Ryan Leslie, who went on to become a huge hip hop producer under Bad Boy and Puffy, and had a huge hit with Cassie, a track called Me and You. The long story short is that we had this group, me, Bashir, Ryan, a few other guys, and we would go around Boston, any coffee shop that would have us, we would regale them with a cappella songs of spicy sexiness. And we were usually paid in scones. So there you have it.
That was a typical hangout night for you guys back then.
Those were the humble beginnings. Yeah, like we would sing, you know, they call me U.S.H.E.R. Like, you know, like we thought Usher was dope.
But did you guys write stuff together back then?
No, so Bashir and I didn't start writing for a long time. I mean, like, he didn't even move to LA after graduation. I did, because my sister had a job as a casting director's assistant out here, and I just didn't know what I wanted to do after college. Tom Cruise's production partner is a woman named Paula Wagner. She spoke at Harvard, and after she spoke, I went up and talked to her after her speech. And we talked for like an hour, and she convinced me that I had the personality to be an agent. And so I was with it. I was like, this sounds like the great. And I moved out to LA on a whim. I sold my comic book collection, moved out here, and never saw Paula Wagner again. But it was okay, because I had my sister out here, and she helped get me an interview for a position at the Disney Channel, a job I kept for all of 2 weeks. I was far too honest on the first day at work. She's like, so what do you want to do in the business? Fresh out of Harvard grad. And I was like, well, you know, I think I'll do Hollywood for a couple of years and make a lot of money. And then I might go back to Atlanta and run for office, which was the truth. It was my truth back then. Wrong answer. Note to the listeners, if you ever go to Hollywood and you're asked, what do you want to do in this business? Don't ever talk about leaving the business. They don't want to hear that. They want to think that they're investing in somebody who's going to spend a lifetime in this business. It's stuff you learn.
You started doing DJing professionally, and I know it's like you were playing at like cool ass places like Chateau Marmont, cool. And yeah, I mean,
well,
like
No, see, I didn't start off there. I started off at places like The Room, you know, sort of divey places, but like cool places where you could play like Dilla and you could play like sort of like stuff that wasn't on the radio. Even as early as 2000, I was already playing, you know, Daft Punk, and it sounds cliche to say, but I was playing like an eclectic mix of music that could, you know, appeal to people who were into rock or into hip hop or into anything. It would later become known as open format. I'm going to be really brief so I can tell you how I ended up at the Standard Hotels in Chateau Marmont. After 2.5 years of being an assistant at Paramount, I decided, you know what? It's been 2.5 years. I'm not a mogul. It's that sort of like arrogance that you have in your early 20s. Like if you haven't made it by 25, you think you failed and are a has-been. So I left Paramount and decided I was just going to be a DJ full time. My parents were thrilled. Not really. how do we send you to Harvard so you can become a DJ full time? I was looking to increase my DJ pay. So I told the guy, one of the places where I DJ at the standard, I was like, hey, can I get some more shifts? And he was like, well, you know, the people love you here. They love your shift. How would you feel about hiring the DJs? So that's how I ended up at the Chateau Marmont. Just because he believed in me, thought I had talent both as a DJ and as a person with good taste, he hired me to hire the DJs for the Standard on Hollywood, West Hollywood, the one that was downtown. And eventually that expanded to the Chateau Marmont and the Mercer in New York and the Raleigh in Miami. So pretty soon I was flying all around the country, going to like Winter Music Conference, hiring DJs. You know, I was friends with every DJ in town. I know a lot of the DJs who are big now. Steve Aoki, super old friend of mine. I remember when we could get him for about $150 a shift at the Standard. You know what I mean? Like a lot of those DJs went on to bigger and better. Well, Mia Moretti still is one of the high priced DJs in New York, but she was one of the models we had in the booth behind the front desk at the front desk of the West Hollywood Standard. And we would talk about music sometimes. And I was like, you know what? Buy some records. Just that's what I did. Just buy some records. You'll get really good at this. And so she became a DJ. You know, when it comes to DJs, whether they went on to be famous like Steve Aoki and James Murphy of LCD Sound System, or some of them became, Shannon Sossman became an actress / model. Like, you know, everybody who's DJing in the mid aughts in LA can say that, like, you know, I hired him and that was a lot of fun.
Well, and this is when you met your wife too, right? Brittany?
So yeah, so I was DJing. The one nightclub that I was DJing where I played nothing but radio hits was a place called Boulevard 3. And every night at midnight, they had sort of like a step up to the street style show that would launch off. And that show, you know, there were a couple of dancers and some of them have gone on to do some notable things. But she was one of those dancers and we were friends for 2 years. And then at some point I looked up, I was single. She was single. I asked her out for coffee. And then 3 dates later, called my mom and I said, hey, you know, I just want to say right now, worst case scenario, I've met my first wife. That's the worst case scenario. And my mom laughed and she was like, well, who is this person? And, you know, it's been 12 and a half years.
Oh, that's awesome. I mean, she's from Alaska. Is that right?
She's from Alaska. She grew up in Juneau. We used to talk about, you know, politics, her politics or my politics. Like, you know, she was just like, oh, Sarah Palin is such a terrible embarrassment to the entire state. You know, we were just people who talk politics. But then one night she just made a random comment. And I was just like, oh, is this friend of mine like me? Well, you know, we could try some things. Just ask her out to coffee. And, you know, it's one of those examples of like, I think sometimes you are not, if you're single, it might be best to just find somebody who you have fun with, because it can be, you know, sometimes there were times when I would date somebody, be like, wow, this person is perfect on paper. But like 2 months in, I'm like, nobody's having fun. but with her, it was just like from the, not really the first day. The first date was a little bit weird, but I think it was only weird because it was like, are we friends? Is this a friend date? But I would say from the second date on, it was pretty clear that like it was heading in a different direction, which is why it was funny by the third date, you know, I'm calling my mom. So like, cause I had never really known what love was. I know that sounds all sappy and ridiculous.
Oh no, not at all.
You know, I didn't know until that moment. And then I've often said, like, you know, for any reason this didn't work out, it ain't happening anymore, because I was single for a decade, and you know, and I was usually, we always joke because I was always the one to dump the other. Oh God, I feel bad now, but yeah, like I was always the one who dumped, and she was always the one who dumped. So when we were first dating, we were like, oh, whose streak gets broken, you know? And so far, nobody's streak has been broken because we've really enjoyed it.
Well, that's awesome. Well, I wanted to ask, I always hear this about how you and Bashir, how you did the pilot for HBO, yeah, about the brothers from Atlanta, and yeah, they didn't pick it up. But I never hear exactly what was the synopsis for the pilot? Like, what was that episode?
Well, there were two pilots. The first one, interestingly enough, I think still one of our most creative ideas of all time. It was called The Reporters, and it's a very original. by the time we shot it, we had made a lot of creative compromises that I think that weakened the formula. But in its purest original conception, it was called The Reporters, and we worked for a small Atlanta newspaper. And sort of like All the President's Men, we stumbled upon conspiracy after conspiracy. But all these conspiracies were based on conspiracy theories that we'd heard Black people say in the past. But in our show, all of the conspiracy theories turn out to be true. So example of an episode would be Tupac is alive. So we go searching for Tupac. And of course, we find him. You know, there was another one about like, you know, James Brown had come on Jimmy Fallon one time and said that he had met James Brown. And James Brown said, hey, man, don't give those bankers your money, man. You take that money and you bury it in your backyard. And he was like, well, what if I forget where I buried it? And James told Eddie, he was like, well, at least the bankers won't get that money. Like that made sense to James. So we said, wow, is James Brown's fortune buried somewhere in Augusta, Georgia? So we did another episode where we went to Augusta, Georgia to find James Brown's money and found out it had been basically paved over, for the lack of a better term, by an all-white golf course, except they had one Black member played by John Legend. So we had to befriend John Legend to get on the golf course with our shovels and dig up James Brown's gold. It's a story that I still want to tell on one of our other shows, like hands down. Like I just think that idea makes me laugh a lot because it's so crazy.
It is. It's a great idea. I can't believe that's like one that didn't make it.
No, but it was a different time. And I mean, like you got to realize streaming wasn't really a place where you took shows back then. And if you took things to the cable outlets, especially a place like HBO, where they were only doing one night of shows, they were only doing Sunday night. Well, they were doing like Bill Maher on Fridays. I think they did Bill Maher and Flight of the Conchords on Fridays, but they only had to do like five shows a year. There was a lot of micromanaging from at least one of the presidents at that time. You know, I don't even think he's still in the business anymore, but it got micromanaged and watered down, and then it wasn't as special. And then that person got fired. Another person came on and said, hey, why don't we just do a show that's a little more grounded than conspiracy theories, but the show you guys want to do. And that's when we did Brothers in Atlanta, which, you know, I saw the pilot recently and I still like it, but I am aware when I watch it, I'm like, we've grown as writers, we've grown as actors. If we ever had the chance to go back to Brothers in Atlanta in any form, it wouldn't be the exact same show because, you know, and when we've used some of those ideas, like, you know, the day the Jordans drop is an episode of Southside. That was originally supposed to be in Atlanta because I remember that people would line up at Walters in downtown Atlanta anytime the new Jordans would come out. So, you know, we've used some of those ideas in other projects, but, you know, like, yeah, we did two pilots with them and it took up 4 years of our lives. And at the time that they passed on the second pilot, we felt like complete failures because we had left Jimmy Fallon for what? To be broke in development hell for 4 years. But after that time, I got cast on Marlon as a series regular and did two seasons there. And Bashir booked a couple of movies, you know, including A Simple Plan with Blake Lively and Top Gun 2 with Tom Cruise. So everything comes full circle. Tom Cruise comes back into the picture.
Well, I wondered when Donald Glover's show Atlanta came out, were you like, oh, good for you?
We were happy for Donald. You know, Donald was originally attached to be in our original show, The Reporters. You know, because we've been friends with him going. I remember when we first met him in like 2007. I want to say he was still just a writer on 30 Rock, or maybe he's about to start doing Community. But we've known him forever. As late as 2012, he was supposed to be in the first version of The Reporters. But you know, because he said he wanted to focus on just being Childish Gambino. And he's like, you guys can write the show. And that thing was in development for so long. He's just like, you know what, guys, I think I'm going to do my own show about Atlanta. And we were like, go for it. And when I finally saw it, I obviously felt a certain way because we had been developing for almost 4 years at that point. Like, I was like, oh, man, like, I thought I was going to have this definitive Atlanta show. But at the same time, happy for Donald. And the show he did was so personal and so, you know, so Donald Glover that to this day, I feel like our Atlanta show would be a completely different side of Atlanta. The same way that his Atlanta is different from the Atlanta and the Real Housewives of Atlanta, our Atlanta is different from both of them, you know? Right. And I think that, look, if Hollywood can greenlight 9 or 10 shows a year, of, you know, young white people trying to find love in New York or Los Angeles, we can have a third Atlanta show, you guys. Like, it's not that hard. There's still some stories to be told. I want to tell stories that involve, you know, a Kasim Reed type character. Like, I feel like the same way our show Southside goes after Chicago and sort of shows you the side that the news doesn't show about Chicago. The news would have you think everybody in Chicago died today in a shooting. You know, it's still, you know, America's third most populous city. It might, is it still the third? It might be fourth now after Houston. But, you know, like, we wanted to show the Chicago that you didn't get. And there's still an Atlanta that I haven't seen in TV or film. So I'm excited about still doing a show in Atlanta.
That's I would love to see your guys's take on it. Because, of course, it'd be completely different than.
It would be so different from Donald and Nene Leakes and, you know, and by the way, shout out to Portia Williams. I think that Hosea Williams was an icon, you know, like, I think it's so cool that we get to see the next generation of Atlanta sort of stepping up to the plate. But again, our Atlanta would be quite different.
Oh, and by the time you actually, maybe if you do it, Kasim Reed will probably be mayor again at that point. So
it's... what is happening with Keisha Bottoms? Why doesn't she want to do this again? Like, I was so excited to see her come in and now she's out. Was it just, do you think it's just the job was too hard?
I think it's too much. I think it's too much for her. It's too much. Uh-huh. And everybody's breathing down her neck. And she's just like, I can't, I'm done with this. This, like, is,
this
too
is
much.
Not fun.
No. And I think,
well, that's too bad. Cause I never got to be in Atlanta under Mayor Bottoms, but I don't know. There's something very cool about Keisha Bottoms being the mayor of Atlanta.
We had a great run under Shirley Franklin. Shirley Franklin,
friend of my father's, you know, like, I will say that my father had a great relationship with Maynard Jackson and Andy Young and Shirley Franklin. So, you know, and by the way, did not have a good relationship with Bill Campbell. So I like to always say that my father was a good judge of character.
Yeah, to me, Bill Campbell is right for to do something about.
Yes, Atlanta strip club mayor. I think there's something to be said about. Actually, I'm sure that we have some mutual friends that we just don't even know about, because very few people, I think, claim Bill Campbell these days. But but yeah, you know, I had two sisters go to Emory. You know, our Atlanta roots are deep. You know, I remember the Mellow Mushroom. So I would love to do something that, you know, takes place in Piedmont Park, and love to do something that, you know, gets you out on Druid Hills and, you know, like all that stuff.
Well, I don't think enough people know, that you and your creative partner, Bashir Salahuddin, that you guys had two hit comedies that got renewed, that premiered 1 week apart from each other, that you both created, starred in, all that. To your knowledge, has that ever been done before?
You know, I don't know. I take pride in the fact that I will take no time in researching to know if that was the first time that happened. But we love both shows. They're like two very different kids. They're definitely fraternal twins. Like, they don't look anything alike. They have very different appeals, but they both got 100% Rotten Tomatoes. And I am proud of that, because the fact is, we shot and edited and promoted and went out and promoted those two shows, you know, all pretty much within the same 9-month period. You know, I would say from the time we started shooting season one of Southside till the time we were done editing Sherman Showcase and went out and did our round of press on that, that was literally one calendar year. So there you go. It was a rip roaring time, but I'm very proud of both shows. And then to come back a few months later and do the Black History Month spectacular for Sherman Showcase, which is on Hulu and AMC Plus. I think that if anybody has never seen Sherman Showcase, start with that episode. As much as I love season one, I think that it's a very crazy, outlandish show. And the best way to be introduced to what it is to watch either episode one or the Black History Special. And then once you've done that, then you can actually, I think, enjoy more episodes that include, like, the beef between John Legend and Common, and Vic Mensa playing a Prince type character who we call on our show Charade. You know, we have Tiffany Haddish and Brescia Webb and so many of our friends, Lil Rel, so many of our friends who came through and just killed it. We had Neo sing a song that started off in my head while I was in traffic.
The time loop song, that's a masterpiece.
And then time loop became a song, you know, like, Yeah, we just want to do more of that. We're writing a song right now with Fred Armisen for season two, a brand new song for John, Legend to Sing. And there's some, I won't say their names yet, but there's some Atlanta icons that I think we might also be able to do a song with for season two. So we're very excited.
Well, you know, when you mentioned the Black History
Month
special.
Spectacular.
Oh my God, that was so good. And I, you know,
and it came out in June.
It came out, which
I love that our Black History Month special came out in June. That's why it's called the Black History Month Spectacular in June. We named it before we knew, obviously before we knew that 2020 would be a referendum on race and George Floyd. So when we actually did come out in June, everybody was talking about Juneteenth. It was a crazy cross. We could have never planned that June would actually be in a totally appropriate month for that show to come out. And even right down to the fact that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer were wearing kente cloth, and we had a song called Add Some Kente. It just felt like we had accidentally tapped into the zeitgeist, like by accident.
Oh, the kente. That's one of my favorite songs. I listen to that. I'm like, I listen to the soundtrack in my car. I mean, it's like a Robin-esque song. They sound like real, like the time loop song. You have to like really listen to know this is not a real song.
That's the thing. It's like we will sort of go out of our way to like record songs that are real songs that DJs can mix. And I know that there was a Japanese DJ who made time loop a part of his set. Right now on TikTok, Drop It Low for Jesus is like all over TikTok right now. Like just, it's almost like people didn't discover it, but now they are discovering it. You know, I think that the music is timeless. And if it doesn't get discovered, you know, if it's like sort of like Nick Cave, you know, I feel like he's an artist who didn't sell a lot at the time, but like people went back and discovered him after the fact. I mean, like, I'm totally comfortable with that. You know, my father was a painter, he was an artist. And he always said, you know, a lot of artists don't become famous until 80 years after they're dead. We just try to make sure everything is good and up to our standards so that one day people, you know, if they don't discover it now, they'll discover it later. But hopefully they'll discover it now. I always tell people, hey, if you saw Southside and liked it, tell five people. If you saw Sherman Showcase and liked it, tell five people. Because we would love people to discover this stuff now. We make some of what we put into these shows specifically for the comic book nerds and the people in the chat rooms who will be like, well, I noticed that your character has an eye patch in 2017, but not in 2016, please explain. And we're like, oh, well, I'm glad you noticed that. And here's the reason why. You know, we write, I'd say half of the reason we write is for those people, the people who are really paying attention, because we paid attention to the stuff that we liked. And so in a way, you're just writing for your younger self.
Yeah, I feel like I was like that when I was growing up, sneaking and watching HBO and things like that. I mean, and all, I know movies by the songs. Mm-hmm. I mean, like all of the theme songs from all of the movies from back then. But I wondered, like I said, I'm from Downriver, Detroit. And when Detroiters came out, I mean, I just lost my mind because it was all about inside jokes that only really people from Detroit completely get. Yeah. But even if you didn't, you'd still think it's funny. And because they gave such a lighter side of Detroit, because you only always hear the bad, like you were talking about.
Yeah, about Chicago. Yeah.
And so Southside, to me, that was like Detroiters. I was immediately drawn into it. And I wondered, do you get feedback from people in Chicago where they say, oh my God, I love it.
All the time. I mean, even while we were still shooting it, we were getting feedback. I got into an Uber one night during season one, and the Uber driver said, hey, I heard you all make it a comedy about Chicago, and the way he said it was kind of aggressive. I was like, yeah, bro, that's our plan, that's what we're trying to do. And he's like, I love that. He's like, you know, I see some of these shows, they make us look really violent. He was like, I'm so happy somebody's letting people know about the joy in this town. And I think that, you know, I think that's great. I think that all the Chicago shows have a place. So like the Dick Wolf shows are showing one type of Chicago. Lena Waithe is a friend. The Shy is a different type of Chicago. It's the same neighborhood, but it's showing something else. And I think, and I'm proud of the fact that we're showing yet something else. I think all these shows have something to say about the city, and hopefully everybody gets a chance to say something.
Have you ever had any, do you have any cops that say anything to you about like Officer Goodnight or?
All I've heard from any sort of, and I haven't heard it from directly, but all the he said, she said is that Chicago cops tend to really like our depiction of the police officers, if only because even though they say terrible things, and obviously Bashir is a very talented actor, it's crazy to hear him say some of the things he says as Officer Goodnight. I feel like they do appreciate the fact that in a weird way we humanize them just by having actors as talented as Bashir and his wife Chandra playing Officers Goodnight and Turner.
Chandra, she is just a badass. I love her character. She's one of my favorite characters on the show. And she does like she's vulnerable.
A lot of people's favorite character on the show. And for those who don't know, that actress, Chandra Russell, is actually Bashir's wife in real life. So they play adversarial partners on TV, but in reality, they're very much in love.
I just found this out like 2 months ago and it blew my mind. I could not believe it.
I introduced them.
Oh, really?
She used to work at, when we were in New York, she used to work the front desk at my gym. And one day I was just like, and we were always friendly. And I was like, hey, you know what? I know this might seem weird, but I'd love to introduce you to my writing partner. I think you guys might be cool together. Go on a date. And then they went on a date. They started dating. And then they got married. I believe it was 4 years ago.
Wow. So one of my favorite episodes is the Mongolian Curly.
Yeah.
And, you know, only just because I've heard so many friends and like coworkers over the years, well, they will make fun of some other woman's edges. They're so, so harsh about it. And like, and the baby hair thing, I've heard a lot about that. And I just wonder, did she come up with the entire concept for that episode?
She wrote that episode. Yeah. I mean, like, she's one of the writers on the show, her, Alicia Cowan, Zuri, who plays Stacy on the show, Bashir's younger sister Zuri, you know, also Rashida, well, we just call her Sheeds. We have a lot of female writers on the show, and we always make sure that they each get an episode each season. And I feel like by bringing in those voices, they write episodes that, quite honestly, I don't think Bashir and I would have come up with. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I've never bought Mongolian Curly. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
So it's, you know, the other cool thing about that episode is that, you know, when we wrote it, we wrote that the proprietor of the store was Asian. And we were like, we had auditions and a lot of the Asian actresses came in and did sort of like stereotypical Asian voice. But then the one who came in and just did an irregular voice, Tian, she's the one we gave the part to. And we thought she was so funny. And she is just a really, really funny actress. At the time, she was Chicago-based, though I think now she might be LA-based. We thought she was so funny. We're bringing her back for season two. Here's the good news. If you enjoy season one of Southside, we have gone to great lengths to bring back many, many of the characters that you just like. You probably thought they were pretty minor characters, but we bring a lot of those characters back in season two in some really funny, unexpected ways. If you're paying close attention, you're going to have so many fun Easter eggs in season two.
Well, this leads me into my favorite episode of Southside, without a doubt. And this isn't just because Alan Gale is in it so much, but it's the mild sauce meatballs. I think I've watched that one. I've watched it probably 10 times.
That's insane.
It Kel Mitchell, when he's running beside you with that plate of spaghetti, I can't handle it.
We were like, Kel is from Chicago. Like, can we please have Kel on the show? And so much fun. He's so much fun to be with, like whether you're filming or not. And then for him to play like, you know, this role that I've never seen him really play before was so much fun. And I don't think that we had him back this season, but that was more of a scheduling thing. We really love Kel and we would do more work with him. And I don't play golf in real life, but my grandfather did. So for me to get back on the golf course was tons of fun.
The pep talk Officer Goodnight gives you when you're about to make that drive. But my favorite part, and I think I'll rewind it and rewatch it, is when Kel and the Demare are crossing the street and the truck's coming. And he just goes, oh, here we go. And he does it and he somersaults out of the way.
The phrase here we go is used frequently on our show when a character is in a situation that they, let's just say it's a dire situation. There are a couple of here we go moments in season two. So yeah, if you like Here We Go or Demare, you're gonna really like season two. Demare shows up season two. It's actually sort of an important character in one episode, but I don't want to give too much away.
Well, Owen, is Adam Bethune, is this like based on somebody you guys knew?
No, he's kind of based on everybody that we knew. Like, it was definitely a guy who went to Harvard with us who just sort of, we were just like, how does this guy get all ever so hard on everybody just for charms and good looks. I'm happy to say that there is a true, like, not physical fisticuffs, but there's a pure battle between Gale and Bethune in season two. It might come up in episode three, but like, you talk about a tete-a-tete. We're actually in editing on that episode right now, but Bethune the buffoon, as Gale was, you know, prone to insult him. Yeah, Bethune comes this season, goes for the big prize, and Gale is there to meet him, and it's one of my favorite mano a mano. Again, it's not a boxing match, but they're competing for something pretty hard, and it drives one of our episodes.
Oh, I can't wait to see it. And I know you got to go. I've been having you on here for so long.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Oh, and but I just wanted to say, or I wanted to ask you, mm-hmm. when does it premiere?
There is a date that's being discussed. Here's the good news. I've been saying this all year. The goal is to release season two on HBO Max before the end of the year, and currently that is the plan. So if there's any news to be made, it is that we are currently on track to have season two of Southside out before the end of the year. That's probably all that I should probably say without getting an angry phone call from HBO Max.
Well, can you tell me this much? Will mm-hmm. there be, in the second season of Sherman Showcase, will there be, now that's what I call white music, volume two?
I don't know if they currently have that. Do you want that?
I mean, I had
in a heartbeat. I mean, like, that's one of my favorite sketches. That's one of the ones I always get asked about, but it's so based on truth. Like, black people are always like, oh man, I thought it was just me. I thought only I like, you know, that Daft Punk song, or I thought only I like Bobby Caldwell. I thought only I liked, Michael McDonald. Like, it's like such a cathartic sketch for so many black music fans of
mine. Well, I wondered, yeah, like I had three songs that I just wondered if you, maybe it would make the cut, what you thought.
Let's go.
Let's go Oasis, Wonderwall.
I am a huge Oasis fan. How did you find me out? Who outed me? I do like Oasis. And by the way, that's not even my favorite song. My favorite song on What's the Story of Morning Glory is probably, I think my favorite song on that album, is it Champagne Supernova? It might be Roll With It. Roll With It.
That's a good tune. It's a good tune. What about?
I also like Some Might Say, and I also like She's Electric. So I'm a stan. I admit I'm a stan. My favorite Oasis song is a B-side from that album that was released on their B-sides album. I forget what it was called, but it was called Acquiesce. So if you haven't ever heard Acquiesce by Oasis, the song is called Acquiesce, and it sounds like classic them from the What's the Story, Morning Glory period. Check out Acquiesce.
Oh, I will look that. I don't think I've ever heard that song.
It's a great song. It's actually Liam and Noel share the lead vocals on that one. So that's sort of rare for them.
And what about Waiting for a Girl Like You by Foreigner? Would that make the cut, do you think?
I feel like sing a little bit.
I've been waiting for a girl, like you.
I don't know if that one makes it. You know what? Instead of that one, why don't we add Hard Habit to Break by Chicago?
Okay.
That's the same era. The name is Chicago. And I am convinced, I once started a DJ set off, like, I was like, I need to come in epic. And Hard Habit to Break got the job done. So I was just like, Hard Habit to Break might make the future list. Okay, what's the third?
I would say, what about Dreams by Fleetwood Mac?
By the way, I feel like a lot of people are, I mean, like, how many times has that song been remixed just in the last 2 years? Right. I feel like everybody's got a Dreams remix. Yeah, that one can go on the list.
I personally really
like that song. I think, you know, when she has and What You've Lost, like when she hits that note, like, it's just, you feel the pain, you feel the you're like, oh fuck, what have I lost?
And oh, really? It's so deep, man. It's so deep. Well, last thing before I let you go, and I swear to God, I'll let you go. Yeah. But this is something I really wanted to know, because I know a lot of people make the Soul Train connection with Sherman Showcase. Yep. And when I was growing up, there was a show in Detroit, and it was called The Scene. And it was hosted by this guy named Nat Morris.
Yeah.
And I didn't watch that one as much as it morphed into the new dance show. That's the one that I really watched with. I think his name was RJ Watkins. And that's who Sherman really reminds me of. Well, and I just wondered if you guys had watched those shows.
No, that stuff is on YouTube. And I encourage people to check out the scene. And what is the other, what was the later version? The new dance show?
The new dance show. Yeah.
The new dance show. Those clips are so crazy. I only discovered it because I'm a huge fan. Do you know the song Charivari?
Yeah, that's the beginning of techno, pretty much, right? Names.
Yeah. So I was looking for that song just on YouTube, and I saw like a dance clip, and I figured it was like, you know, maybe there's a Chromeo video that's supposed to look old. But then I saw, I'm pretty sure it's from the new dance show. I don't think it's the scene. It might be the scene, whichever one it is. Like that host was clearly like three lines in. He was so high and glassy eyed. But like the dancing and all that stuff, it was so fun to watch. It was just a really fun, fun YouTube experience. So yeah, I would suggest to anybody who's listening to this that if you really want to look up Charivari, and then when you see like an old Detroit, when you see that the screen grab looks like Soul Train, it's an old Detroit TV show. And that is one of my favorite YouTube, that is definitely on my favorites list.
I mean, I didn't know, but you know, the scene, like that show, that was the first African American owned and operated television station in the country.
I didn't know that.
The only one.
And of course it was in Detroit, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. And that guy, that Nat Morris guy, his story is amazing. And I can't believe nobody's ever told it before, but he was the host. And
what's the story? Can you lay it a little bit on us?
Well, he was a DJ. And then he was a DJ for the station. I think the station was WGCL or something like that.
Okay.
And so they hired him as a DJ, but then they were getting this TV station going. He didn't want to be on TV, but they told him he had to do it. And so they just threw him out there. They said, just play some music. They got all the dancers from like Martin Luther King High School. They just went around to projects and stuff and got dancers and put them on the show. And he said they gave him no budget, nothing. The second year, I think the tubes went out. And they just were having mismatched cameras. They didn't give a shit, nothing like that. And he just kept it going. And then I think in 1979, he just took it over. And they paid him $5 an hour, really, to do the show. And he made it even bigger. Then he started bringing on, like, white kids. He would put white kids on there. And he said, like, they all had the last name, like, Pulaski or whatever. And he said, I think they were Polish, but they had rhythm. I threw them on there. And he went to, like, 1987. And when I read about the story, I thought, oh my God, this seems like something you guys should do. It would be such a great story. And I can't believe nobody's ever done it.
I can't believe it either. And I, just to be clear, I looked it up, and the Charivari clip is, it was when it was still called The Scene, to be clear.
Okay. Well, there you go.
81.
So then you get the birth of techno involved too.
What's that?
I said, that's like the birth of techno too.
It's a great song. I just love the idea. Listening to his car cassette. Like they're trying to say how cool this guy is. And the way that is because his car has a car cassette. It's like, wow. He doesn't have an 8-track. He's got a car cassette. Well, by the way, when I was younger, I thought that they said listening to his darkest set, like he was a DJ who had recorded his set. And then he was like, check this out. This is my darkest set. Like it's so full of himself, but car cassette is really funny too.
Well, thank you. You have been more than generous with your time. I thank you so much, and I just really appreciate you doing this. It means a lot to me. I'm such a huge fan.
Thanks for having me.
I love you guys. So I can't wait to watch the new seasons of both shows.
Oh well, you know, I can't wait to hear you're gonna have on next.
Thanks a lot.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. Try again.